Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. We are a welcoming congregation. We strive to welcome you, no matter where you are on this journey, this religious, spiritual, faith journey, no matter your age, your ethnicity, the color of your skin, your gender identification, your physical abilities or non-abilities or limitations, your family structure, no matter where you are in the journey, we welcome you. If this is one of your first times here, I always urge you to come back more than once because our services are very different each Sunday. Sometimes they are led by me, Prairie's minister. Sometimes they are led by people within the congregation, and sometimes they are led by people outside the congregation. Donna, you're doing the opening words, I believe.
These words are from Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham Jail. It's a very, very long letter, and it was, and the letter was written on, I think it was April 17th, 1963. I must make two honest confessions. Oh, it's written for the newspaper and was published in the newspaper as a response to some arguments that were going on in the newspaper at that time in Birmingham. I must make two honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. First, I must confess that over the past few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klaner, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, "I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I cannot agree with your methods of direct action," who paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives in a mythical concept of time, and who constantly advises the Negro to wait for, quote, "a more convenient season." Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection.
With humility and courage born of our history, we are called as Unitarian Universalists to build the beloved community, capital B, capital C, where all souls are welcome as blessings, and the human family lives whole and reconciled. With this vision in our hearts and minds, we light this chalice. Colleen Kerr is here, yay. And he's the founder and CEO of One City Early Learning Centers, a preschool, which I have heard of, designed to ensure children are reading ready by kindergarten, and that their parents have the knowledge, tools, and ability to provide for them and to lead strong families. And I would also like to say that you're nationally recognized as a social entrepreneur and a leader in community and organizational transformation. And we've been talking a lot about organizational transformation in the last few weeks. So I believe you and your wife, our partner, have five children.
That's right.
And you live here in Madison.
Yep.
So take it away, and we are
actually
very
not that far from here.
Of course not. We are very pleased to have you.
Well, thank you, you all. Luckily, I just have this right here. So, I like these Macs, too. They're like, their battery doesn't die. It takes a long time. But anyway, thanks for having me here and having me talk a little bit about the Justified Anger Initiative. I want to talk a little bit broader than that, too, because there's a little bit more about that initiative and what impacts it. Today, just this morning, I was reading as I was getting ready to leave the house this morning, the newspaper online, and it was another post about the police stops. And right above it was a story, a good story about the new leadership in the school district. And I just thought that that was interesting, that they were right at one was above the other. But as I read it, my cousin is Brandy Grayson. She's one of the leaders of Young, Gifted, and Black. And I just shook my head, even in the title about Black stopped 10 times or arrested 10 times more than anyone else. And I just shook my head because I said, man, I have been reading those same articles for years, you know, and it's just like, it makes you feel when you see that, that there's nothing happening, like there's no progress at all. And then sometimes it makes you feel like you're even taking steps back. So as I read through the article, I read comments by the police chief and by Brandy. They were the two, they're always kind of juxtaposed to each other. And I read the chief's comments and I read Brandy's and I said, man, still, you know, I'm gonna call my cousin like you. I know you haven't read the history like I have, but you sound like Betty Franklin Hammonds 20, 30 years ago and, you know, just it's the same thing. And so with the Justified Anger Initiative, you all, it just illuminated why it's even more important that we're doing this. But it also spells out how challenging this really is and is going to be. I got involved with the initiative while I was still at the Urban League as their CEO. Alex G has been a close personal friend of mine for years. And I spent a lot of my time in my grandmother's house across the street from his house on the southern part of Fisher Street. I lived at the northern end, or southern end of Fisher Street. He lived at the northern end down the block. And he was preaching at 11, 12 years old. So my grandmother, after we'd go to church, our church service was a little earlier, we'd come home. She would then pull out the lawn chair and sit on the front steps and make us listen to him preach as a little kid. And I was sitting here, you know, you're little. That's the last thing you want to do is be in church for 4 or 5 hours, right? But that's how long I've known him. And when I got back home, every time I would stop through, because my wife and I were members of his church in the 90s when we lived here, we left in 2000 and went to DC. So every time I would stop through, he would always be one of the people I would go see. And as I left Madison, we were all sort of discouraged. I felt like there was a glass ceiling here, like there was not a lot of opportunity for us here. This wasn't a place where we could manifest change. And then I left and I came back. Every time I would come back, I would feel his shoulders sink a little bit more, you know, in our conversation. And he had this great idea about building his church, and he was really enthusiastic about that. And then as I came back, I started to see that his feeling and belief that could happen start to dwindle to the point where he was literally being pursued by churches in New York City and Seattle to come out there and preach there, and he was seriously considering it. And I told him when I got back here after spending a few months going around listening, I said, Pastor, I said, the one group we got to organize is us. And I said, I'm not the person that can do that alone. I can inspire us. I said, but you know, the number one place that we've always been organized is through our church. This church is still a very central part of the Black community. It's becoming less so as our children get older and they're not in church as much as some of us were when we were little. But for those of us who are older and still have some influence, it's been a huge part of our upbringing. And it is the one place where we can come to the table and lower our boundaries and our walls that we put up between each other and actually make something happen. So I told him how important it was for him to get engaged. And it took him a little while because he travels a lot. But when he put out the Justified Anger document, the article, Paul Fanlon, it started with Paul Fanlon of the Capital Times asking, he and I and Michael Johnson, we got into this exchange in email that August. And he asked us if we would all write something. And I told him, no, I'm not writing. I'm done talking. You know, I said, you guys can write something. I said, I don't have anything else to say. It was about the Ku Klux Klan, and they were doing this article and recognizing the 64 Civil Rights Act, and he wanted to show this timeline, and there was this big march of the Ku Klux Klan downtown, and we were talking about should we put that on the cover or not. And I was just like, look, it's history, man, put it on there. Mike and Alex had their own view. And next thing you know, I get this call from Pastor, and he said, you know, Paul's asked me to write something. I met with him, and I told him I want to be real, Colleen. And I said, look, man, if you're going to write something, I said, you got to go in on it. I said, you know, that means for us, that means you just got to tell the whole truth. You got to put it out there. And he did. And next thing, it hit people in a different way than the work we were doing at the Urban League, or all the conversations since. It was more personal. But after we did that, we got ourselves together and started to organize. And what we realized was that, you know, we're even more fractured within the Black community than what we thought. We knew there were always two Black communities, but now there are three. There was always that group of folks who came to the university from all around the country, and they were much like other folks that will come to the university. They may have an interest in the city, or they may not. And if they have an interest in the city, it's more a function of their research work that they might do, the neighborhood area that they might live in. It was no long-term commitment by many of them, unless then they stayed here. But even when they stayed, they didn't have that cultural, historical connection. So often they formed their lives in somewhat separate to ours, and we would only meet in church. But then the third group that emerged was a group that William Julius Wilson describes as a truly disadvantaged. In his book, he's a former University of Chicago researcher now at Harvard, but he talks about how there's a different, because I call it an underclass, of African Americans who have been so deprived of the type of things that we in America would consider just a normal part of life and what we should have, decent schools to send our kids to. Children in places like Chicago, if you ever went to some of those schools, before we started to make a few more investments in them, they were just dropout factories. You go there, it's like there's no education going on in here. It was a joke for the staff, it was a joke for the kids. It wasn't like we were serious about these children. So he talked about how they're prepared pretty much to go nowhere, right? The function where they can always go get a job in industry, but as industry caved in those communities, that wasn't there, and it exposed the fatal flaws of education. And so we started to see more of that emerge in our community through the 80s into the 90s, where people were moving here to seek a better way of life for their children, trying to become that part of American society that they've always wanted to be, that we always want to be, and we are right now, only to be met by a city that after a while started to reject them because, oh, well, there's too many folks coming here. It's too many. But we did the same thing. Those of us traditional African Americans who lived here, whether we were poor or not, we had a different mindset. And so we rejected and responded to those folks negatively too. So you wouldn't see a lot of them in our churches. You wouldn't see a lot of them in our social networks. So now you have the Black, we call it elite class, which I'm a part of now, where we have education, we have resources, we have connections, we have influence. Our phone calls can get returns, you know, things like that. And then I can get invited to do things like this. And then you have the next group, which are here, they're working, they might be involved, they might not, but they're not doing that bad, or if they're poor, they still don't know that they're poor. You know, it's like, it's not a mindset. But then you have a large number of people, which make up the majority of our community, African American community now, that have probably always been disconnected from prosperity. And that is who we are trying to help. So imagine trying to call people of color, even, who have resources to the table, to try to get them to advocate for young people who and adults who are nothing like themselves. That's the challenge we've been met with. There's a book called A Warmth of Other Suns, and it's S-U-N-S by Isabel Wilkerson. You should read that, because there is some explanation in there about the type of experiences Blacks from the South had when they came to the North, and how they were even treated by Black people in Chicago at that time. Same experience. So when we tackled this issue with justified anger, we realize we have so many challenges, you guys. We got to close ranks. We got to figure out how we're going to come at this. And so that's when we said we're going to do this as an African-American-only first-focused initiative. And it wasn't because we just felt like white people always want to decide things for us. Now, Madison, there is a tendency for white people in Madison to do that. But we think that most of them do it out of the goodness of their heart. They just sometimes don't realize that we also have an opinion. But that wasn't the driving, motivating factor. It was this divide among us. And it was tough in the beginning. We lost some leaders from the table when we had these meetings at first. We had, dissension and disagreements, people having to walk out in the hallway at the church to tone down and talk through stuff, and it was serious. And, we worked our way through it, though, and I tell you, without doing it in the church, we would have never been successful. If we had to try to do that with people at the Urban League, there would have been no higher calling, there to keep us in the room. And so we ended up what we think is a good framework that focuses in five areas, education being the first area, which we think is really, really important. It is still the foundation for success in this country. It's even more important now than it had been in the past. Employment, we call it broadly economic development, but that's jobs and the availability of employment and jobs in the same place. And ability to be entrepreneurs as well, create your own job. And so we put that on the table as well, knowing that Madison still is a closed environment for us in many ways in terms of work. You can be African American with a great education here, and it can be very difficult for you to find work. Some of it is Madison's small town mindset still. It's about who you know. And if you're not in those circles, your chances of getting opportunities are slim. It's also, people have adopted this view that unless we serve black people, do we really need to hire you? So we have all these community relations jobs, these parent coordinator jobs. It's like, if there's a job for serving black people, then you got a job. If not, no, I'm not hiring you for the vice president of finance. Really? Are white people really going to give you your money clean? That kind of thing. And so that's been a mindset here that's been ingrained. And then the third area was incarceration. And for us, the challenge with incarceration is that we lead the nation in the percentage of African American males in their formative years, age 25 to 29, who are incarcerated on probation or some form of corrections. And Pam Oliver at the university has told us that we routinely lock up about 47% of that population is on paper or in jail, which is huge. It's almost half of them. And the other half are largely undereducated. Those are our school dropouts, so the ones who didn't do very well in school, have a hard time finding those type of jobs here in Madison. So they still have issues. So we looked at that, incarceration. How do we both prevent people from going to jail by doing the first couple of things, but also when they get out, how do we help them truly reintegrate into this community? The fourth area was family wellness, and we really wanted to look at that, because that's important. So much of what goes on is not just about medical health, it's about how all those other things impact your well-being. And so we really brought those things together. It's been quite the experience to get people to agree in this community that we should focus in any of these areas. In the area of education, one of the things we're looking at doing is eliminating the pair for the Midvale-Lincoln, less concerned about Franklin Randall, but the Midvale-Lincoln pair, because it disadvantages poor families in South Madison. I took the bus quite frequently as a kid, so when I came back, I liked Madison. I liked, past tense, Madison's public transportation. So I jumped the bus from when I was living in Owl Creek area out there near McFarland. A friend of mine lived off of Signal Cow Road, my best friend and his family, before they moved to Georgia. I lived with them for my first 18 months here until my family arrived. So I said, I'm going to catch the bus to the Urban League, see if I can do public transportation rather than just drive all the time. It took me an hour and 45 minutes to get there, and I could drive there in 13 minutes just by hitting the Beltline. And so I was like, man, what? They can't just get a bus to go down the Beltline and hit Park Street or something like that. And so this whole new transfer system is a mess, I think. But it disadvantages families because they're busing kids from that area who go to school over there. They go to school all the way at Thoreau and these different schools. So it's like, how do they get there in time for the kids? But all the kids are on the bus for a long time, but then the parents will be too. And in the South Side, it's, you know, it's an hour and 5 hour and 10 minute bus ride if you're one of the first kids on the bus, because everywhere it has to go to pick up buses to get to school. And you know how much we talk about kids needing sleep and us kids not having to go to school so early. And so these children have to get up earlier. They have to get to the bus earlier. And these are our kindergarten to 2-year-olds. So they're being dropped off at the bus stop by their parents. But man, when those kids get home, our center for One City is right on Fisher Street. And at the corner of Fisher and Baird Street, Bram Street, or Baird Street down there, that's where they would let them off. All these little 5-year-olds get off and just scatter by themselves. There might be one or two parents who could be there to pick kids up, but you're talking like 20, 30 kids getting off the bus and they're running home by themselves. Kids in 3rd to 5th grade are going to Lincoln and being bused back to the Midvale area. Now, Midvale families have a little bit easier time making arrangements or, you know, getting people to pick up their kids or being home when their children ride from home. So, you know, they're being disadvantaged in those ways, but then to get from there to Midvale, from South Madison to Midvale, it's 1 hour and 30 minutes on the bus. You have to go to the South Transfer Point, catch it down to Regent Street, catch it out to the West Transfer Point, get off at the West Transfer Point, and go back to Midvale. And it's just crazy. So we said, let's get rid of the pair, would be one. The other one is about creating a pipeline of opportunities from preschool all the way through higher education for our children in this community, and really revamping public education around the needs of the children that we serve now, not the ones that we served before. Now we have kids who, they need a lot of education, they need a lot of experiences, they need a lot of exposure because their parents cannot provide that for them. They don't have the means to do so, even if they knew how. And so our schools, you know, we don't have technical education in the schools anymore. But we have all these technical jobs. If you can get a job in coding, you become a coder, and you can make 80, 90 grand a year if you're really good. But also our schools aren't teaching kids how to do that stuff. If you want to be, industry for construction is booming right now. And they're talking about how they don't have young people to work in these jobs, so they're getting people from all over the state to come in and do all this work. But we're not training these children to do those kinds of jobs in Madison. And so, you know, what we're doing is we're still giving them a 13-year liberal arts education, where we teach them about all the classics that in their world don't matter. You know, we teach them all these things and we get them out there and then we say, all right, be inspired. Now you can go to college. Really? I need a job. You know, I need to make some money. And they need to be able to see that in their future. So we said, let's wire the schools around that. Another big one we are calling for is the elimination of CCAP. And when I brought it up with some friends, if you know what that is, it's a Wisconsin court access portal where you can go online and look up anybody's record. And I think it's ridiculous, you know, that the public has the ability to do background checks, right, on their own. And everything's on there. Even if you were acquitted, it's on there. So just the fact that somebody could find you were accused of something is ridiculous, you know. So we want it to be a system that someone either has to pay to access, pay a significant amount if you want to do a background check, since those are all the rage now, and pay, you know, $60 every time you go and check this thing. It will deter people from using it as a vehicle to just look up anybody that they want, or eliminate it, which we think will be a little bit more challenging to do. I had one lady tell me, a friend of mine, she literally was acting negatively because she uses it to look up people she might date. I thought she was joking with me. She was seriously arguing with me about this and how her friends, I was sitting here listening to her like, man, I'm in another time. You know, you're arguing about that. So we're looking at that because people will use that to look us up to see, do you have a record? And if you have anything on there, credit, bad credit, or anything, people use that as a means to not hire you. And I can tell you, when I was at the Urban League, I still work with companies behind the scenes. I did some work with Edgewood, an issue that they recently had, very quietly, to try to help them resolve an issue they had with a student. And they did, I think they that went fairly well. But I've done a lot of this for companies in Madison. And these CEOs will tell you behind the scenes, when you don't put them out there, that their employers, they found out that they do use these things to unfairly screen employees before they even decide whether or not they're going to totally review their application. They look at zip codes, they look at where these people come from, they look at their last names, their surnames, all these things making judgments. So we have to eliminate those things. So I'd encourage you all to go online and look at the Justified Anger Report. There's a lot in there for me to cover with you right now. But we're trying to eliminate structural barriers, things like that, and trying to replace them with structural opportunities that we actually think will benefit every child. So that was another thing that we focused on, was when we come out with this in a city like Madison, and in the times that we're in, a city like Madison, too much change that people can't be a part of is not going to happen. You know, that was my experience with Madison Prep. I was like, charter schools, I came from the DC area, I was helping develop charter schools. It was an acceptable practice by Democrats, Republicans. I mean, it was just what you did. I came here and was totally met with, I was the arch enemy, I was a Republican, I was conservative and right wing and all this other stuff. I wasn't prepared for that part of it. But I said, you know, we know that too much is going to change. It impacts the culture badly here. But then the other thing was, we're in a society and a time now, we need to find ways to also positively impact white kids and Latino children. We got to be the type of people that we want everyone to be for us. And so we thought about that when we put these things out there. How would these things impact those families too? And to take you back to the parent, we looked at it and said, for political and economic reasons, if white people with money leave this city, and they are, young people with kids are going to Verona and Sun Prairie and Wanakee and even out further than that now, Edgerton, all these places, if that continues to happen, what happens in urban communities with resource allocation in schools, we're a city who still is largely funding our schools off of property taxes. If they take that money and they leave, and the need of the children goes up, we're closing in on 60% poor and 60% non-white children in these schools, and they're severely poor, and they have to do more with these children, and you have fewer resources, what happens? Total system destruction. It's what's happened all over the country. So we can't afford to let that happen here, and because we can't get in the brains of people and change their thinking about where they live and who they send their kids to school with, we said for economic reasons we have to eliminate the pair, because if we lose all these families out of this community, our kids will suffer on the economic side of it. So we looked at that too. And unless someone can fix that, we have to stay the course on our strategy. So you all, we need as many people to be involved in this as possible. There's a whole lot of people that showed up to the kickoff. I don't know if some of you were, I'm sure, I know Dorothy was, some of you were probably there at Align Energy Center, but we're at a point right now where we're heading into that next phase of really catalyzing two groups, those entities and organizations in Madison that are really going to be the ones that help us do this work. Those are the YWCAs, the folks that actually do services. That's the school district. That's that group of people. And we've asked someone who really does this work nationally to get involved with helping us bring those groups together. And then the second group will be individuals like yourselves and organizations like this, where we're going to ask you all to jump on board with us in an area where you feel you can make the greatest difference. But identify what area do you feel like you could attach to in the Justified Anger strategy? And then what could your one or two things be that you do around that? Because we feel like if we give people small goals to focus on, and a lot of groups and people start focusing on that, then we start really changing the culture and the community here. And so be a little patient with us on that. We're still probably 2 or 3 months away from moving people through that, because now we got this next big group of people to organize, but we are making good progress on it. And I'll stop with saying that this whole issue of police stops and arrests that we're now talking about today, and what the mayor then we're doing with homeless people downtown, moving stones and bricks and things like that, you know, we say one thing, we talk about wanting equality and equity and opportunity, but we act totally different on the other side. We got to start acting in the way that we talk. Part of being engaged and empowering people is giving up some power and control yourself. If people in this community don't want to do that, if they don't want to give up the ability to make the decision, if they don't want to be able to give up the ability to actually decide where the money goes and allow some other people the opportunity to make that decision, then we'll wind up with situations where my Madison Prep Charter School was going to go into Old Mount Olive Church, which is now going to be a police precinct on the west side. The arrest things that we're talking about, my school, I'm telling you, I know most of my kids wouldn't be going to jail. And we would have most of those kids who would be ended up going down that road because those are the families we were declined and designed to serve. But now we got a police precinct there that can get easier access to West Madison to police them, arrest them, respond to police calls, whatever it is, and lock them up. So we keep investing in things that will not make the difference. But talking about making a difference on one side, we got to bring those two things together. You know, time together does work. And it's also time, who do you spend that with? I can tell you one thing that we struggle with, the African American of this cult called elite class, right? We're asked to be in a lot of different places, and there's so few number of us. 80% of black people in Dade County fall below the federal poverty level. So, and you'll see that in terms of home ownership rates, 80% rent, you know, 20% own homes. And so those of us that would otherwise have the time and the means to participate, you'll find us in 14 different things and all struggling with figuring out how do we participate in them all. So what we'd have to do is do that, but find a way to connect with that other 80%. And I think that people are open to that. It would be a little new for some of them to have folks reach out and get involved, but I think trying to get involved in what they're doing first is one way to do it. But people are open to it. There's a few things quickly. One is encourage your friends or people you know to hire us. You know, I mean, ask that question. If you walk into places, so that we aren't the ones always doing it, why aren't there that many black people here? You know, if you start to ask that question, people start to think about it. When we ask it, sometimes they don't think as much. And so that's one thing, is that make sure that we have opportunities open to us for employment. The other thing is, we've got to break this deadlock in our school system about this power and control mechanism that doesn't allow us to do much different. You know, we're talking about, I liked what Jen was talking about with these marginal increases in student performance. But at school, you guys, we got to totally reconfigure this thing or it's not going to work for our kids now. And we have to be open to that. So creating a forum and for a discussion around things like that, around creating change, real change, so that people become more susceptible to it, they're less fearful of it, that would be really important. And the third thing, housing in this community is crazy. The things that people can do to get away from, and my wife and I, we rent a house. We just now got ready to rent another house. There was one guy who said we had to have a 720 credit score in order to be able to qualify for his house. Now he had that was blanket, so for anybody, but it was his way of saying, I'm gonna get somebody who's got some serious loot, serious great credit, or I'm not gonna get certain people into my place. And we found all these different ways people are deciding who can be in their house. And I'm like, there's no common way that people screen you. It's like everybody has a different thing. It reminded me of the old restrictive covenants where they could write into their deeds and things that they couldn't rent or sell to black people or Jews or Italians. It's like we're doing that all over again. So challenging that system is important too. I never thought I would say this, but in the last year since leaving the Urban League, it's been easier to look at the world too in Madison from the outside. But I think that we have a great chance to solve this problem here. And if you had asked me that 2 years ago, I wouldn't have told you that. Because I was in the middle of it. I was in the heat of the battle, you know. But the amount of activity that is taking place in this community right now around these issues is significant. And I also think we've got to find a way, I've got to find a way to talk about that more frequently, even just spot more what it is, because I didn't used to see black people on construction jobs in the city anywhere. When they built WID downtown, Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery, in the South, I could just keep going on and on and on. I would go in there, you know, always be told to put a hard hat on, and I would ask, you know, where are black people at? And these guys, most of them, they either weren't in this community or they weren't even thinking about it. But with Joe Parisi's work, with us at the Urban League and Big Step and some others, I mean, you go on these jobs now, rarely do you see a job where there is not at least one, right? So there are some, but there are, and some of these jobs are 6, 7, 8. I mean, it's significant. Employers, I walked in UW Credit Union, I told Bill Johnson, their diversity person there, y'all gotta do a better job of hiring black people because they've got a lot of Latino community members working there, but 2, 3, 4 years ago, you saw one or two. You know, now you see a lot more. And so we're seeing some progress in some of these areas. The superintendent is trying to do real change. Her teachers are struggling to implement real change, but real change, that's what happens. So, you know, I haven't written much about it because when you're trying to change, that's when you don't try to kill people, right? Because it's hard enough to try to make something new work. So I'm just sitting watching, happy that people are trying to do something very different. But there's still more that we got to do. I lobbied Jack Daniels with a number of people to put that school in South Madison. And it wasn't because it would be closer to the neighborhood. It's that it would stimulate economic development. It would bring large numbers of young people and adults who are going to spend money up and down Park Street and help us to develop that area. And the more resources and things that people start to see being put into the community, it creates more job opportunities for people down the road. Imagine if we get a Starbucks, right? So, I don't like Starbucks coffee that much. I prefer some of the local coffee makers, but it's still jobs for people. You know, it has a multiplier effect on neighborhoods. Other people then start to see those neighborhoods as investment worthy. We start to get opportunities from banks to actually take out some loans to improve the houses that we have, rather than looking at our area as a dead area that's never going to build any real equity. So we always have a struggle trying to get any money out of the local banks. So for those reasons is why I was advocating for Jack. Man, look, if you can bring that many people to South Madison and downtown, somebody's going to buy that lot and build something significant in that lot. Downtown will not be hurt by the loss of that downtown campus.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. It's overwhelming, but that helped a little. Helped me a little. Closing words.
None of us wants the racial divide we have today. None of us. But how do we move forward? How do we build the world we dream of? The problem is not cognitive. We can't think our way to the beloved community. Workshops and trainings won't get us there. We build a new world through action. We build relationships. We build alliances. We must open ourselves to experience the other. For once, we truly experience one another in depth, and over time, the other is no longer other. They become we. We have to cross the borders of race, culture, and class. Building the beloved community takes time. It takes commitment. It is soul work, and together, we can do it. Peter Morales, President, Unitarian Universalist Association.
Go in peace, greet your neighbor, and thank you again for being with us. Thank you.